from the Carter Subaru Studios, this is the G and Ursula Show with G. Scott and Ursula Voitin.
Good morning. Happy Thursday, and thank you for listening to the G and Ursula Show. Good morning, Ursula.
Good morning, G. How you doing?
Oh, got a pep in my step.
Yeah.
And I cannot confirm nor deny if there was a possibility of grits in that last break.
And I know for sure you've been drinking coffee again. Keeping it real.
Yeah.
It's all good.
I have. All right. We got a busy time coming up right now, so let's get to it. Three things that you need to know at 10.
Number one.
And we start with a rally that's going to be happening tomorrow. Women who work at the King County Courthouse are going to be rallying to demand safety changes. This comes after a pregnant employee was attacked in a bathroom last week. Khyber Radio's Hannah Scott joins us live with details. Hey, Hannah.
Hi. Yes, this is going to be happening right outside of the county administration building, so right there across from the courthouse. And at noon tomorrow, they'll have some speakers. And really, it's the entirety of the women who work in the courthouse and their supporters, others who work, men who work in the courthouse, and the unions, the coalition of unions that represent them, who are now essentially demanding that something change. They've been fighting for safer conditions at the and around the courthouse for many, many years. Some folks may not remember, but back, I believe it was 2004, 2008, there were three women who were shot and killed inside the courthouse. It's been a different kind of danger that's been posed as of late, where we were talking about some of the homelessness issues and things like that, but it's just been ongoing for years. So Suzette Erickson, she is the chair of the coalition of unions who's organizing this. And she said, after what happened last week, it just rattled everyone.
It was shocking to, I think, all of us. When I heard it, I can honestly say that, you know, that rattled me. It rattled a lot of people. I was getting calls immediately. I was getting messages forwarded to me. We've had conversations with our membership and, you know, trying to facilitate and to hear their voices and, you know, to ensure them that we are going to take a stance for them. We are going to work on their behalf.
And that's absolutely what they're doing. They've already sent a list of demands to the county executive.
We asked that there be deputies that patrol the floors, that patrol outside, that, you know, even security that patrols more security that patrols outside, that cameras be put up, staff only bathrooms with keyed entries. So we've made a list of demands up front that, you know, the exec's office has said that they will be working towards getting those done.
So she went on to tell me, though, that the message here is, look, stop your fighting to, like, Mayor Durkin and County Executive Constantine. Stop your whatever county versus city stuff. You need to just figure this out. This cannot be allowed to happen where someone is attacked like this in the bathroom. We're not going to take it anymore. And I said, or what? And she said, they're in talks about the or what part of it. But they're really, really upset. And you also have at the prosecutor's office, State Senator Monka Dhingra, who's very, very upset, put her prosecutor's hat on. She'll be out there speaking as part of this as well. So it should be a big crowd. And then they'll march around in front of the courthouse.
And Hannah, you didn't mention any demands about what happens to City Hall Park, where that encampment is.
And it's there's not a specific demand that they said to me regarding that. I will tell you, though, that I did hear from the public defenders group today. They're part of the Just Care program that you keep hearing about, the $15 million investment. They're ready to go. They expect to be doing that here in just the coming days. They're just waiting for the contract and the money from the county and the city. So, but that should be coming. It was my sense. So that should be happening very soon over the next few weeks. But the problem is that they will just take care of those who are there now. As soon as that park is empty, if others set up camp there, that's not going to be under their purview at that point. So something will have to be done to avoid that.
Wow. Okay. I mean, this has come to a critical point, clearly, when you have employees who are demanding changes. You have the sheriff who says the non-public facing employees in the sheriff's office who occupy that building should be working from home. You cannot expect anyone who is asked to do jury duty to feel safe coming into that building. We will continue.
It's unacceptable. It's unacceptable. I can't say it enough.
It's ridiculous. Yes. Okay, Hannah Scott, we appreciate you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Number two.
So as we await final results from the primaries, one of the tightest races that we're watching, and many people are watching, is the race for Seattle City Attorney. Three-term incumbent Pete Holmes is on the ropes. I mean, it's essentially he's got two other challengers who got about as much as he did in the primary. In early results, surprise right now is that Ann Davidson is currently leading the vote tally, and she joins us now on the G and Ursula Show. Good morning, Ann.
Hello to you.
Thank you so much for joining us. So you just heard Hannah's report about the situation at the courthouse, the frustration. The last hour we talked about the couple that went into the homeless camp in Seattle, where they went to retrieve their stolen items and then ended up driving over someone and killing them as they left after they were getting attacked. You, as a Seattle City Attorney, what would you be doing differently to address this revolving door of the criminal justice system where so many of us are so frustrated about how criminals keep getting back out on the streets?
I mean, I am sick to my stomach having to hear what we've just heard about that workers have to come and protest about the conditions at their workplace to be safe. We have allowed, under Holmes's approach for the past 12 years, to have a reputation to invite crime to come here and clearly settle in. And we need to change that because it is affecting everybody, sheltered and unsheltered. It really is. And we need to center victims once again in that process. And that is what has been missing and is clearly now the manifestation of that over this 12-year culmination has brought us to this serious, serious point. And I state it the same as they do. I could walk to that courthouse in 2008 and go in that Third Avenue side and didn't really think much of it because it was relatively safe. In 2010, I could also do that. When my second child was born in 2011, it was a little starting to get something. Now jurors' employees are told don't even go in that door. And now look at what we're having to do. The workers are having to protest for safety. It clearly is not working. We must address crimes at that level, at that misdemeanor level, because otherwise it invites increasing in severity and frequency. And then we have people who cannot simply do their job in the administration of justice for other victims of even more serious crimes. This is absolutely abominable that we are having to have this conversation.
Hey, Ann, you mentioned that in 2008, you walked in there, no problem. 2010, you walked in, no problem. Can you give us an example? Tell us a story in which you started to walk in and you said to yourself, whoa, things are changes. Help us better understand that.
Well, you just started to notice a decline of care for people. And so maybe when I'm walking and I feel more vulnerable because I'm maybe in, dress shoes, in a suit, maybe I would cross the street or something because I know I'm not capable to maybe take care of myself better than in other situations. I'm not fearful of people. I regularly go into encampments to do outreach. I was at one actually last night till quite late. So I am a athlete, so I know how to protect, and I do jujitsu, so I know how to protect myself. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I'm vulnerable and fearful, but what I'm saying is it is clearly shown that we see the deterioration of the standard of care, basically, is what I'm going to call it now within our city, where the standard of care of public safety has gone down to where it's immeasurable that we have no standard of care for public safety. It is completely broken and we have to retrieve it because there is no other way but this seat correction to start to fix what we call the grouping together that creates public safety for all of us because it's cross jurisdiction. It is cross agency and that's not happening. We have no collaboration as you're just talking about city versus county. Who's doing it? Everyone hands off. It is time to get to work and make sure that we have people going to work safely. That is the job of our leaders. I'm sorry. I'm getting really riled up. I am so upset
Keep going.
That we are having to do this.
You mentioned standard of care for public safety. I want to talk about that. What's happening right now? Is it politics that makes it seem as if that's not being addressed? Or is it that there are people that just really don't care? Can you help us? What do you see in that situation?
I do think it's politics. I think it's language and vernacular of the day. And what I've been here for 25 years, you know, and I'm certainly not saying, oh, we need to go back to some good old days type of thing. But we absolutely need to be talking about improvement and being productive and moving forward. But when things were managed and, you know, and I didn't even think about local politics when I moved here because things were managed. We could take care of the most vulnerable. We could manage public health and public safety. And now we do need to come to terms to reconcile the fact that we are failing to meet the needs of the most vulnerable, in addition to not being able to perform the basic functions of public health and safety. We are failing everyone at every count. And so that standard of care is just not there. And I think it's because people that we've elected into office are tied up on concepts and vocabulary buzzwords other than practical policies that affect all of us in our daily lives of trying to get through life, whether it's get to work, run your business, raise your kids, you know, be a single person trying to get across town. I mean, it's everyone. And it's at all sectors of society because it impacts us all. We have got to do different, and the politics needs to be just put to the side. This is about the practical aspects of daily life here in Seattle only.
So I want to talk about a ruling in 2019. The Ninth Circuit Court decided in Martin versus Boise that homeless people cannot be punished for sleeping in public if there is no alternative housing. And the Supreme Court declined to review the decision. So that case basically set precedent for local governments. And we talk about this to seemingly throw up their hands and say there's nothing that we can do. So as Seattle City Attorney, first of all, how would you interpret that ruling? Would you do it differently, if at all?
I think that ruling has, it does have consequences for us. It does have impact. I think it's been construed in a way that is not quite the way that it was intended. It is to make sure that we are not criminalizing, and it was not to create cruel and unusual punishment for someone who has no alternative but to sleep outside. Because that is absolutely true. It's cruel and unusual punishment to say, oh, you don't have a place to put your head at night, so therefore we're going to put you in jail. That should not be the case. But it also doesn't say that we aren't allowed to protect our public spaces. It doesn't have that in there. And so I think that it's important to understand that there is a way to do it with compassion and safety. And it doesn't have to be just a blanket response. And I think that that's what we have seen here, where we don't have people of courage willing to have the conversation of we can care for people and we can protect our public spaces. We can have it both ways. We can do all of it if we manage and we have dialogue. And right now we just have arm's length and vernacular, and we don't have action. And it has been for years, right? We've been on this declared state of emergency since 2015 at the city and county level. I participated in that King County point in time count in the middle of the night of January 2020 when we came to that 11,751, which is our number we have for those unsheltered in the county. I know how we got there. It's just basically we look at the tent, we guess how many people might be able to fit in there, and that's the number we recorded. That's the number we have. That's the number we start with. But we have to make sure that we are addressing that, you know, appropriately. This seat is not the source of where we address all of those needs.
Right.
This seat is to take care of the societal limits so we can make sure that they're safe and that everyone else is safe. And then once we have that and we bring down the fear level, because we as humans will not be making rational choices when we're in fear, whether it's, you know, should be justified or not justified according to an outside perspective, right? Everyone is allowed to have their own sense of safety or fear. No one else can measure it for them. But once we bring that down, we can make better decisions as humans in interacting with one another. And then the rest of society can function and take care of the needs of the most vulnerable, because we're failing to do so.
And I want to ask, because you mentioned, at the seat that you would be, if you were to win, you would not be dealing with some of this, but what would you do that would be within your purview? What would be your number one priority if you were to win?
I think, again, we have to center victims, and victims of crime are sheltered and unsheltered. I'm in the process of trying to help a young man, and I pardon if I get choked up and I start to cry when I speak of him, because he's literally starving to death. And he's been assaulted and has a head wound, and we can't get him in. And he's now assaulted his partner, and you know, it's domestic violence because they are on all kinds of substance, and just out there and inches away from Aurora at any moment could pass out and be dead and cause an accident and all of that. This is grave concerns. We have got to make sure we are taking action. So the laws on the books are there. They are there to tell us what we as a society reflect our values. And we need to use those. We need to use them to provide protections for everyone. And that's really the starting place. Centering victims, whether they're sheltered or unsheltered, is the first and foremost thing we need to return that system to. That seat needs to be a place of legal advice to those who are elected to create policy, which it is failing to do on the civil side as well, which we've seen the whole debacle with the texts and then the lawsuit to the press, on and on and on, and now it's been dropped. It is mismanagement top to bottom, doubled the budget, less work, more crime, low prosecution. It is fail, fail, fail. And I have got to get in there. We have got to have better leadership there.
This is the voice of Ann Davison. She is candidate for Seattle City Attorney, and she joins the G and Ursula Show. And one of our last questions for you is this. First of all, I'm going to tell you right now, I don't get to vote in Seattle, but if I did, I'd vote for you. Now, that's one. Mm-hmm. Two, here's my next thing I want to say. I feel like when we ask you about it's just his politics, I don't care that you're a Republican. And as a matter of fact, most of the time, I don't care. Like me personally, this is me. I don't care about Republican or Democrat, what's the R or the D next to their name. I just care about the candidate. So my question for you is this. If and when you were to get into office, how do you battle and fight with that? And how are you going to be able to do what this city needs to fight through all of the who's got the R and who's got the D next to their name?
I so appreciate this question because, I mean, I've never been a Trump supporter. The only kind of Republican I want to be likened to is Dan Evans, who is a longtime Seattle resident and our three-time governor, who welcomed Vietnamese refugees here when the Democratic governor of California wouldn't let them in. That is what I'm talking about. It doesn't matter. It is about social issues. And what is societal cues telling us is the solution that we need to address for society's issues. And right now, what society is screaming at us here locally is crime is increasing. Social spending is increasing. Prosecution is decreasing. So that tells us that the money is not the answer, or it's not an inappropriate programs where there's measurable outcomes to get to the interventions that we want to have for people. And it tells us that there still does need to be an increase in prosecution for that because it is not working for some who are resistant to those alternatives. So it isn't about political party at all. It is about what does society tell us is needed. And then you be fluid with your approach. And right now, that is the approach that's necessary because we've become so imbalanced for the past 12 years of having this place where no one speaks for victims. And so that is nothing to do with politics. It is completely people and issues and the practical life of day-to-day here locally in Seattle.
Ann Davison, candidate for Seattle City Attorney. Ann, we wish you all the best of luck going forward.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure talking to you, and I will see you, everyone, at that rally tomorrow. I'm making sure my calendar is clear so I can participate.
Thank you, Ann. We hope to have you on the show again soon. Appreciate you. Okay, still ahead, we are going to be talking to Nicole Jennings, our reporter, on the closure of an emergency room in one town and all these healthcare workers who are leaving. You are listening to the G and Ursula Show. Welcome back to the G and Ursula Show. Thank you so much for hanging out with us this morning. If you haven't already done so, I would love it if you like and follow us on Facebook. Be part of our community there. We promise it is going to be a very positive social media experience, which doesn't happen often enough, but our group there is fantastic. So throughout the course of the pandemic, we've been doing everything possible to prevent emergency rooms from overflowing with COVID patients and other patients, really. But one local ER is shutting down, not for a lack of patients, but because of a lack of staffing. And our reporter, Nicole Jennings, has been looking into what happened at St. Michael Medical Center in Bremerton. Hey, Nicole.
Good morning.
So they had to shut down the ER. Tell us about that.
Yes, the ER at the Bremerton St. Michael's has closed. Silverdale, which is about 7 miles away, that St. Michael's there still has its emergency department open, and they're redirecting patients to go there. But the Bremerton location, they simply didn't have enough staff for the overwhelming number of patients coming in. As we talked about when I was on the show a couple weeks back, hospitals just all around the Puget Sound, all around the country actually, are just overwhelmed with people this summer for a variety of different reasons, notably people ignoring routine care during the pandemic, staying home instead of getting those screenings, and now having more serious problems that require hospitalization. And so hospitals are just seeing patients coming in droves. And at the same time, doctors and nurses are leaving in droves.
Okay, we're getting some technical issues here. So you're popping in and out. But basically, you said it's not just because hospital staff is leaving, but also it's a very typically busy season, and also compounded by the fact that people put off their health care and now they're coming in. So it's trauma season, people put off health care, they're coming in, and now we have people leaving. Why are people leaving the industry?
They are just having severe burnout. I mean, if you can imagine, and I can't imagine what they're going through every day, they have had the most physically and emotionally demanding year and a half since the pandemic started. I mean, they're dealing with severely sick and dying people every single day, long hours, overtime, never getting a break, never getting a moment to just collect their thoughts and relax. And so it takes a toll on a person. And then what I've been told from the CEO of the Washington State Hospital Association is that seeing patients now coming in to the ER and the ICU, and pretty much everyone who's coming in with COVID now is unvaccinated, seeing the fact that people refuse to go out and get the cure that is available is just really contributing to the burnout. It's absolutely demoralizing.
Right now, Nicole, can you talk about what's going on that people right now are having a hard time? They're having trouble getting spots in long-term care facilities after some of this hospitalization. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, it's the same thing. I mean, just a lack of staff. And I've seen this in my own family. The last time I came on, I was talking about my grandpa being in the hospital. It took him a week after he came out of the hospital to be able to have someone come out to the house and help out a nurse, a visiting nurse. It's just a lack of staff all around. I mean, and this is a person who came out of the hospital unable to walk, unable to make himself meals, and it still took a week.
Down in Thurston County also as well, one of the problems right now is the wait time. They're saying there's up to 90 minutes wait time in the parking lot because there are so many patients and too few workers. From the people that you are talking to, what is the long-term plan, especially since considering COVID cases are ramping up again and hospitalization is going up? Or excuse me, what is the short-term plan, if you will?
You know, they have a lot of contingency plans that they did last winter during the wave, like opening up extra wards, moving like we talked about in the emergency rooms. They're moving gurneys and creating, you know, kind of makeshift beds, makeshift rooms. But yeah, the staffing is the problem. Cassie Sauer, the CEO of the Hospital Association, told me it's not necessarily a lack of beds and a lack of rooms. It's more the lack of staff. So with St. Michael's, for instance, what they did is they consolidated everyone under one roof of a place that was larger and did have more staff. So they moved everyone to Silverdale, where at least you have kind of this bigger, better facility that has a better chance of taking care of more people in one spot. So different moves like that, the more you can consolidate people where there actually are more staff members, moving patients to places that can better care for them. But ultimately, what they're asking the public to do right now is to get vaccinated, because that's the single biggest thing that we all can do, and just keeping ourselves healthy in general to help allay, you know, some of this overwhelming demand on hospitals.
Nicole, we appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, and I know it was kind of hard to listen to because of the technical difficulties, but at the same time, like, this is not just, obviously this is a problem going around the country, obviously happening here locally, and this has been the fear, right? When we start talking about COVID and
in cases possibly going up higher. We talked about this last year in 2020 and what this can do in some of these towns and some of rural America where you don't have the facilities. Like sometimes, like my old basketball coach, my college basketball coach, who we had on our show, who was on a ventilator, where he lives in a small town, they had to take him an hour and a half away. Mm. Right. So when you start having these situations, there's not enough hospitals to, if you will, take care of all of us if we all get sick all at the same time. So this is an alarming problem.
Well, it is. But yet there is such a resistance to believe that it is a problem. And we and everyone else who reports this gets accused of hyping it up. And yet we talk to the doctors who say the same thing, and then you'll see people post on social media things like, well, I talked to a nurse, an entire wing of the hospital is empty, so this is not true. I'll tell you what, as I was talking about this 2 days ago, a friend of mine texted me, and she said, I am just leaving a hospital over in Kitsap County in an area where a lot of people don't believe that COVID is real still to this day. And she told me that her cousin, who is only 40 years old, is dying of COVID. Mm. Her cousin to this day, even when she was still able to talk, was trying to deny that she had it. But the doctors told her, yes, in fact, she does. And she, once you get it, and they were hoping that she wouldn't need the vent, but now she does need the vent. I mean, you're talking about a long stay. So you can't, it's not like you can just rotate people in and out. And yes, there are other, I mean, this is trauma season on top of everything else. And you were sharing that you have a friend who is
right now, doing all of the, has COVID that's turned into pneumonia. And so I'm really praying for him, he and his wife and everything. And he has COVID and has turned into pneumonia at the same time. And so right now they have him on different machines right now to try to help him before the possibility of getting on a ventilator. So I'm just going to think positive thoughts so that he does not have to go on a ventilator.
And we understand it's hard to listen. It's hard. And when we say, you know, please get vaccinated, we're not talking about the people who absolutely really can't for health reasons. Someone reached out to me and said, I'm feeling so guilty because you keep talking about it. We're talking about it for the people who can get it and who can still do something so that they're not texting their loved ones at the hospital bed saying, I wish I had gotten the vaccine. I mean, it is very real. And if we share the real stories, you know, I hope it changes one person's mind.
Okay, coming up next in scenarios, find out what happens when the in-laws go snooping in your suitcase. We discuss that next. It's Gene Ursula. It is the Gene Ursula Show. Coming up at 11 o'clock in Agree to Disagree, should talking smack about your ex-job cost you millions? We do that in Agree to Disagree at 11. But right now, it is time for Scenarios brought to you by Farrah.com.
Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo. So what's the scenario?
My wife and I just got back from a driving vacation. The road trip recently started out by hanging out with an old friend from college for a couple of days. It ended with 3 days at her parents' house. All right, here's where I'm going. As we were leaving my friend's house, he gave me a couple giant chocolate candy bars. I had never seen them before, but assumed he brought them back from a road trip. He travels a lot. So I put them in my bag and carried on our way. We got to my in-law's house, and my father-in-law took us fishing. While we were gone, my mother-in-law was cleaning up in our room and saw the candy. Well, I guess she couldn't resist. She ate an entire candy bar. Now, when we got home, here is where the problem starts. My mother-in-law started to hallucinate, and she started complaining that her heart was racing.
Oh, no.
Yes, they called 911, got her to an ambulance and everything. She spent overnight in the hospital. Come to find out, she had overdose on hallucinogenic drugs. Yes, my buddy gave me a mushroom-infused candy bar, just like we used to do in college. I didn't know that he had done this. He did not tell me. Now, I admit it. I was honest. I admit it what happened, and now everyone hates me, including my wife. She's mad at me. I have apologized, and I tried to explain that I did not know. Right now, nobody wants anything to do with me. And the more I think about it, the more angry I get, actually. Why was she snooping through my stuff in the first place? And even if it was a candy bar, you stole a candy bar out of my bag. Am I wrong here? 98973 is a State Roof and Text line. Ursula, you're up the bat first.
First of all, can I admit that I was today years old when I learned that mushroom-infused candy exists?
Me too, and you'd think I'd be hip to that.
Okay, so let's just go there. So apparently, yes, in fact, does exist. The mother-in-law shouldn't have been eating something without permission out of someone's bag. So that's the first thing. The fact that people are blaming this person who, if it's truly the case, didn't know that these were mushroom-infused chocolate bars, there's no liability there. There's no guilt. It was an unfortunate situation brought on by the fact that the mother-in-law thought whatever was in that suitcase was something that she could partake in, which was the first problem. I think it's easy. Chef?
Is it easy? Chef?
Did I miss part of the story?
No.
Because I was still Googling the part about mushroom chocolate bars.
Did you not believe the story?
I just had not heard of it.
That blew me away.
That's kind of like racism when people say, I didn't mean that towards you.
Oh, please.
I just blame the friend. This isn't 100% the friend's problem. Like, there is nothing funny about accidentally dosing someone or, like, giving someone something that they don't know has drugs in it. So, I mean, I assume
that's
your friend
too.
was planning to tell you at some point, but what if you just taken a bite out of that thing? Like, are you kidding me? And then suddenly you magically have, wow, a mushroom trip going on. That is insane.
Something's not sitting right about that story. I can't believe he didn't know someone's going to give you a chocolate bar.
People
like
wouldn't
that.
Lie when okay. they write to us, Ursula. That being said, I kind of identify with the mother-in-law because I've seen a bag on a friend's counter and was like, oh, jerky, I'll eat that. And my friend had to tell me, hey, buddy, those are dog treats. You don't want to eat those.
Inside someone's suitcase, though?
Well, it wasn't in the suitcase, but, you know.
Okay.
So, okay. The reason why Ursula is saying that something's not sitting right is because it's the same thing that I feel, too. Do I believe that the friend put the candy bar in his bag? Yes. Do I believe that the mother-in-law was nosy and that's her fault? Yes. However, I do believe that Buddy knew that those were infused with mushrooms. Let me tell you something. You don't give someone two big old candy bars and let me go ahead and put that in your bag. I mean, who's to know that he might go on a conference and he might need a little sugar real quick to kind of get him a little pep in his step, and he takes a bite of that and messes up his whole presentation or something like that.
Oh, I'll tell you.
I think he knew. Uh-huh. He knew that they were infused. So what he's doing is he's telling the truth, but he's kind of telling the truth. Yeah. He's not telling the whole truth.
He's lying by omission.
Yeah. I mean, I'm familiar with that. I mean, as some of the times I got caught with the cell phone number that shouldn't have been on my cell phone line back in the day. You admit, okay, let me admit to that number because I know I didn't talk to her that much. But I don't want to admit to that one. That is a big one.
Oh, boy. Honk, honk. and by the way, lucky that a dog didn't get to it. Dogs, you know, sniff out the chocolate. That would be trouble, too.
Coming up next, agree to disagree. Should talking smack about your ex-job cost you millions? G and Ursula.